Bella Mackey.
Hello.
I think you may have two of the greatest titles for any books ever in the history of books. That's all we need to say. Thank you very much. Good night.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. What a way to go in How to Kill Your Family. Hello.
Yeah. No, they are good. And I chose both of them. So I shouldn't probably say that, should I?
No, you can.
It sounds like I'm bragging.
No, they're your books.
Yeah, they are my books.
Actually, I much prefer that you chose them.
Yeah.
But a bit weird if you said, no, somebody else gave.
Well, sometimes the publishers do choose. That happens quite often, that the publisher chooses.
Well, okay. Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So quite often it's, you know, marketing comes up with things that they think, buzzwords and things that they think would work. Sometimes, you know, a writer will have no idea what they want to call their book the entire way through. And someone will suggest something and they'll say, yeah, that sounds good to me. So sometimes it depends. With me, I really want to choose my own titles. And I had a bit of a fight about this one.
Which one? The your new one?
About What a Way to Go, yeah.
Why?
We went through about 15 different titles, and marketing was saying, well, we really like this one, and my editor was saying, and I like this one, and I was saying, no, I want this one, and then back and forth, and then we came up with some ridiculous titles that kind of, I've got a whole page list of really embarrassing title suggestions, and we kind of got to a stalemate, and eventually they went, okay, fine, we can call it What a Way to Go. And I think they only let me do that because I came up with How to Kill Your Family, and that was a good one. So I think they're a bit like, well, if it fails, that's on you.
This is really weird, because I think What a Way to Go is the most genius title.
Well, I like it, but I mean, to be fair, it hasn't come out yet, so the proof will be in the pudding. But I checked with other people because I thought, is this a very English phrase? So I asked my hairdresser, who's French, I said, would you say that in France? She said, yeah. And I asked an Iranian friend. So I got a bunch of other people to give me their options because I was sort of losing confidence. But yeah.
I had no idea that you didn't choose people not
always,
choose their own titles.
No, not always. I mean, it's interesting. I'd love to know about, you know, I'd love to know whether like Dickens chose all his own titles or whether his publishers were suggesting David Copperfield or, you know.
I can imagine somebody like Dickens. I suppose now, because he's Dickens.
Yeah.
But then,
you know, it might have been that a really canny publisher said, okay, we're going to call it, you know, whatever it was. You know, it's interesting. Not everyone picks their own titles. Yeah.
Obviously, your first book as well. Genius.
I
How to Kill Your Family.
Yeah.
That what's so wonderful is the reaction to that book and the reaction to the title.
Mm.
You must have known that was going to be a reaction.
No, I had no idea.
Really?
I really honestly have no confidence. And I mean, like most women. And no, I thought, you know, I thought I was really hopeful that, like, you know, maybe 10,000 people might buy it because that would be really successful, you know, for a first novel. I had no idea. And I think a lot of that has to do with the title, that people picked it up and thought it was a funny title and catchy. And a lot of people bought it for family members to say, you know, don't kill your family. It's not a manual. So a lot of it, I think, was to do with the title. But I think also in publishing, everything is, it's an alchemy. You just don't know what's going to do well and what's not going to do well. There have been books I've read recently that I thought have been some of the best literature I've read in years, and they've not sold huge amounts. So I think it's completely chance. It's really not about talent, or I think a lot of it's just luck.
Well, I have to say I disagree. I Had to Kill Your Family. From the title, you want it.
Mm.
The minute you go in, you're there, and you want to stay in that book. And to me, I like a book to grab me from the very beginning, and it did. And I wanted to be in that world. For me, I love books. I absolutely love them. But I want to be in that world, and I don't want something to take me out of that world. That's why it's great to be able to put the phone aside. Mm. And you're in that world. How do you do that? How did you bring us into that world straight away?
Do you know what? I think it's because I felt like I was in that world when I was writing it and thinking about it and living with those characters. And I think, I don't know. I think it's something to do. I mean, that was my first novel. So obviously I don't have a huge amount of experience of kind of, and this
oh,
is
hello,
how you
but
do
it did really well.
Yeah. But I think it's because it's a subject that I was so interested in myself. You know, I'm so interested in the super rich. I'm so interested in that world. I've always been interested in that world. I remember reading Hello magazines when my mum was getting her hair done in the hairdresser and just being fascinated by these people, you know, in their society galas and their ball gowns and, you know, their diamonds and riding horses, all these insane things. I was fascinated from a really young age. And my mum always thought it was completely bizarre. And so I guess as a result, I'm so interested in the worlds that I'm writing about, which is obviously a luxury that I get to write about what I'm interested in. I can't write about whale watching because, you know, I have very little interest in it.
Oh, you've got to go. Have you ever been whale
watching? I would like to watch it.
Yes. Can I tell you, it's one of the most remarkable
things.
Where
did you go?
I was in the San Juan Islands in America. It was truly one. I did it for a TV show, but suddenly digress. But please do it.
It was a bad example. It's only because I saw a TikTok video of a whale breaching in Ireland this morning and I reminded myself of it. But of course, that's actually very interesting. So of course you'd want to see that. Something else.
Anything else.
The life of germs. I'm not interested.
No.
Again, quite interesting.
Oh, that could be quite interesting.
It could be quite interesting. I don't know why.
That'd be quite interesting.
I know. Very interesting.
Are we interested in everything?
We are.
Let's find something that's not interesting.
But that's the thing. As a writer, I think you do find everything interesting.
Watching cross the road.
I'd be fascinated by that.
Actually, I think I'd.
Yeah,
I'm
you
just
would.
Trying to.
You'd
okay.
think.
A fly flying around in the kitchen.
No, I'm interested by that because I think, where do you think you're getting out? What's your intention here? You keep going to the same place. What's happening here?
Okay.
I know. Maybe not animals because I find all animals.
All right, all animals. So, okay. You tear the corner of the newspaper. That's not very interesting.
No, okay, fine. I think you may have found the one example that I wouldn't find very interesting.
Okay.
There you go.
Although there's a little bit of me that wants to find out what was written on the rest of the torn bit.
See, there's always something.
Ah!
But that's the joy about writing, is that you can always find, there's always something that you can dig down into and find interesting. So, but for me, it at the moment, it is still the world of the super rich. And I find that endlessly fascinating. And the class system in this country, I find that fascinating.
How's their reaction been?
The rich people.
Yeah.
I don't know, because I don't know if rich people read it. And
if they do,
they don't tell me that they've read it. You know, they wouldn't get in touch with me.
You need to infiltrate.
I know. Well, I did get a message from someone who I thought, Instagram, sometimes people message me and say things about the book. And she messaged me and she had an honourable in front of her name on Instagram. So then I looked her up and she is the daughter of some duke.
What did she say?
Well, she just said, I love the book and it was so great and blah, blah, blah. But I think she wouldn't have found it. I don't think it would have chimed with her life, because the people I've written about in this book are kind of new money. And so I think for her, she would have thought,
this
is very interesting reading about this completely different type of person to me. And so that's the class system. You know, everyone is in their own little category and sees everyone else as something else. So, yeah, I don't think she'd have recognised herself at all. Maybe in the new one, which is about kind of slightly older money.
Older money. So what you need to do is you need to infiltrate a Hallo event. And you need to go in disguise, big hat, dark glasses, and you need to distribute the book around while they're not looking.
Well, it's funny because you say that, but I was speaking to someone who
You've done it.
No, I mean, I wish I'd done it. I don't even have a copy of it at the moment. I was speaking to a journalist I know who works for a lifestyle magazine. And she said, I was talking to her about my new book, What Way to Go. And she said, I don't think you've been... harsh enough. And I said, oh, why not? And she said, these people, Bella, she said, you don't understand, they're not rich like you've written them. There's next level rich. She said, I know of someone who has so many houses around the world that when they came to London, they stayed at Claridge's and they spent one night at Claridge's, and then the husband sort of slapped his head and said, darling, we have a house here. And they had forgotten.
No.
Yes. That they had a house in Mayfair, round the corner from
Claridge's. Oh, no, I don't like that. See,
yes.
I don't like it. I don't like greed.
I know.
I don't like greed.
I know, but so you see, I think I've downplayed the wealth and the power and the money that these people have, because I've kind of said, oh, you know, they've got two nice houses and, you know, maybe sometimes they get, you know, a private helicopter. But these people forget that they have houses.
I don't like greed.
Neither do I. But that's why everyone in my book gets their come up.
Yes, I was
No one really, I mean, they might profit from it financially, but, you know, ethically, morally, spiritually,
yes,
they're not doing well. So, you know, I think that's the fictionalized element of, if you see something in the world and you don't like it, you then write it fictionally and
brilliantly.
Yeah, and come up with your own conclusion for these people.
Let's go backwards if we can. You speak so openly about mental health and about your anxiety and about running and all of these things. For me, it's that you suddenly were a journalist and you've written, and so I love all the way you're so open about everything and you speak your mind, which I love in people. But also that you suddenly say, that's it, I'm going to do the book. What was that moment? Because I'm so, the way that you got there, the running book, and all the other stuff that you've written, suddenly you say, I know. I'm just quite fascinated by that moment, that light bulb, that click.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think, again, it's like a confluence of events that were lucky in that, you know, my husband left me and I started running and I felt better about my anxiety and my OCD and all of these things that had been sort of crippling me for a decade. And then I wrote this book about running and mental health. And then because that did fairly well, I thought, okay, they're going to let me write another book at the moment, you know, because you're only as good as your last book. And I thought, okay, fine, they're going to let me do another book here. And they kept saying, you know, would you like to write a book about, you know, trampolining or, you know, skydiving or, you know, what else could you write a book about? And I said, no, none of those things make me happy. I mean, they might make me happy, but I haven't explored them. So it would feel disingenuous to then say, you know, and now trampoline yourself happy. And so that was the kind of slight gamble. I knew they'd let me write something, but I know that they wanted me to write more mental health nonfiction. And I said, can I write a novel? And they went, no. They said, well, that's not what we were looking for. And then I sort of pitched it to a couple of publishers and I got rejected by about three publishers who said, nice idea, but no. And then eventually my original publisher said, okay, look, we'll take it for quite a low advance. But by then I was like, okay, foot in the door. So, you know, let's see if it works. And luckily for me, it did work.
Because so. it's quite a leap. I mean, okay, you're like I said, I love you for your honesty about everything and your anxiety. The coming out and saying all of that and helping so many people as you did, that was quite a big leap for you to be so open about everything. Yeah. And then the next step, and believe, I love the fact, that's why I was asking you where it came from, that moment, because from everything that I've read, that you had that anxiety and you didn't believe in yourself, but then you believed in yourself enough to do that novel. And that's what I was interested in.
Yeah, no, you make a good point. And there clearly was some kind of confidence there, which was, you know, I think was because I kind of got over quite a lot in that 5 years, you know, husband, you know, marriage breaking down and sort of dealing with my mental health. And I had a stalker during that time. Yeah. And so there was lots of bad stuff going on. And I think because the book came out and did well, and it did help people and people responded really positively to it. And because I think it took a weight off my shoulders of thinking, I don't have to hide the fact that I have these issues. Yeah. You know, I don't have to kind of minimize them or pretend they're not there or try and make myself look more palatable to people. I think there probably was a confidence there at about 35 where I thought, oh, okay, you know, here's a springboard and I can take it. And I'm not normally like that. I'm not a kind of grab opportunities by the...
Yeah, but
you know,
not normally, but now you are.
Yeah. Well, no, I think once. And
okay,
then
okay.
Once, and that was amazing. And I think now I'm very nervous because I think, oh God, I've got to try and do that again. I don't know.
Do the nerves come back?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I sort of thought maybe it's that life lesson, isn't it? You think, if I can just get to X, then everything will be fine. You know, if I can just get to Y, if I can just, you know, make X amount of money or buy a house or whatever it is, and you think then life will be great. And of course that's not realistic. You know, life doesn't just suddenly slot into place. So even though the book sold really well and I've been so lucky with it, I thought, oh, and now I'll never feel anxious again. And actually you feel more anxious. So
it is, but it is.
Yeah.
I mean, handing a book over, as any author always says, it's or a musician with their new album and they've had a successful first album and they go, here we go, you're handing over your baby. And then somebody else is going to be looking after your baby and saying what they think about your baby.
And sometimes, for the first draft, you don't like your baby.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you get moments like that?
Well, yeah, because the pandemic happened sort of in between. And I was really anxious during the pandemic and really sad and sort of worried all the time.
Understandably, a lot of people were.
Yeah, a lot of people were. Yeah. And I had it much better than a lot of people, but it was just the mental health element of it. Just, I didn't react well to it. And so I was trying to write a funny book while feeling really sad. Mm. And I wrote the whole thing. And then my editors sort of sat down kindly with me and did that head tilt thing. And she said, I'm not sure this is the book you want to write. And I kind of was devastated thinking, oh my God. But when I read it back, I thought, oh yeah, none of this is funny. It's not funny at all. And so I threw it away and wrote another draft. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. 130,000 words.
Literally scrapped 130,000 words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you had actually somebody hold your hand and say, this doesn't work, and they knew how to do it. But it didn't stop you from doing it.
No.
See, that's huge.
Yeah. I think it did make me much less confident with what I was doing. But then actually, once I started writing again, you get into the groove of it. You know, there are times when you're writing and you think, I hate every single thing about this. It's terrible. You know, no one's going to read this. Ugh. And then there's times when you're in your groove and you're like, okay, no, this is good. This is funny. I'm getting there, you know, or you hope it's funny, but you find it funny. And so, yeah, you bounce back, I guess. And so this has been my difficult second album in the musical analogy. Yeah. And hopefully the third one, which I've already plotted out, is much easier because I sort of know what I'm doing. I've been plotting it out with my dad. We've been going over all the specifics.
Oh, that's so lovely.
Well, because we both have this real interest in crime.
Yeah.
So he used to read me true crime bedtime stories. He'd read me about sort of Dr. Crippen and the Brides in the Bath and stuff. It was always old murders. I think maybe he thought
How
that was
you?
Less. Oh, like six, seven?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And he bought me a subscription to a true crime magazine when I was eight. And that was really disgusting.
I think, but I love that story. Yeah. I mean, obviously around you, you had journalism and writing and everything around you. But I love that you had this shared thing.
I know. I know. I mean, some people bond over, you know, football or, you know, lots of normal things. And me and my dad bonded over weird crimes, which we still do. He will text me about a weird crime, you know, at least once every kind of couple of months and say, what do you think? What do you think? Who did
it? So a real
crime. Yeah, real
ones. True crimes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he'll be like, what do you think? Who do you think did it? I think it was X. And I'm like, you are 70 years old. You should not be.
I love
you should not be saying that.
No, let him. I think that's fantastic that he's still thinking like that.
It's I know.
Absolutely
it's funny.
Brilliant.
It's very funny. So yeah, I'm plotting out that one, but I think I'll stick with the crime element of it because I just find crime so. I mean, everyone does, right? Everyone finds some element of crime fascinating. It's such a weird instinct that we all have, you know.
I mean, the true crime podcasts do.
Oh my goodness!
Amazingly yeah. well. My elder daughter. She listens, she goes, you'll never guess. So. Sometimes I'm just, what are you listening to?
I know. And then also, but also with the rise of social media, it's not just the kind of true crime podcast. It's also that everyone now has an opinion on things that are happening in real time.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, I mean, you look on TikTok at the moment and there's just, they're all looking at this one specific case and they all have their own theories. They all have their own, you know, conspiracies.
But again, I was just about to say the conspiracy theories terrify me.
It's terrifying.
Because people then believe it and there's no budging it. They go, oh, well, I heard that. Yeah. I read that. I saw that. TikTok, I saw it on Instagram. It must be true.
Yeah.
And that actually does worry me.
No, it's awful. It's completely out of control because it's no longer just, you know, reading about something and having an opinion. It's going online, sharing misinformation, perhaps affecting a victim's family, you know, all of that kind of thing. So I actually don't imbibe true crime myself at all anymore, partly because I remember I once was talking about it on Instagram and I got a message from someone who said, I'm really glad that you don't imbibe too much true crime. She said, because my sister was murdered.
Oh,
and
my God.
I know.
Oh.
And she said, and the worst moment of my life, obviously, apart from finding out that her sister had been killed, was she was in a changing room in a shop. And in the next cubicle, there were two girls discussing their theories about how her sister had been killed and who had done it.
Oh.
Yeah, because it had been on a podcast without the family permission.
Without their permission?
Yeah. So I now sort of steer clear of true crime, but I like to get my fix with fictional crime, which I think is, you know, probably slightly
safer.
Yeah, exactly.
Slightly safer.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what I always find so funny is that when people do write fictional crime, that people say, what's going on in your head? But actually, we all have vivid imaginations.
Mm.
And personally, I think we should keep our vivid imaginations alive. As kids, we have it, and then something happens when you turn into an adult. But we should keep our imaginations alive. It doesn't mean that there's strange things going on in your head.
Of course not. And also the other thing I'm quite careful not to do is I think lots of fiction, crime fiction is, and you'll know this, it's quite gruesome. It's normally there's a female victim and a surly but handsome detective, male detective who sort of doesn't know how handsome he is and he's a bit troubled. And quite often the women in those books are just the bodies, you know, and you read visceral descriptions about how they've been, you know, mutilated. And it's quite harrowing in a way. So the crimes that I write are comedic. You know, I don't want to trigger anyone. I don't want to make anyone upset.
Yeah,
I don't want anyone to feel like they can't go to sleep that night. I want it to be funny. My main goal in writing now is just, I want people to laugh.
You care passionately about how other people cope with life, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I hope everyone does, you know? I mean,
well, no, because what you do is you're trying to help others. I absolutely, like you, believe that, I try and believe that everybody is good.
Mm.
I really do. I look on the bright side of everything. But what you've done with everything is, like you said, you want to make somebody smile. You want to make them feel better. You're running, but you wanted to help them with their mental health. You passionately do care. And that's what I get from everything that you write and everything that you do on social media and all the stuff that you do with Mr. Mackey, is that you want, that you care about people.
I do care about people, and I do want people to feel good, and I want, but I think equally, I think I feel really strongly about certain causes, but in a way that I want other people to care as much as I do about things that I'm interested in. And that's maybe not a good thing. You know, I sort of, I feel like I have to hold myself back sometimes.
But why?
Well, because I think there are things like I'm a vegetarian. I think if I had my way, if I was overlord for everyone, I would ban all meat for sale, you know, and I feel like if I don't hold myself back, I would be going on Instagram every day screaming at people saying, stop eating meat, it's terrible. Do you not know what it does to the animals? So I think I do want to help people, but I think equally I have to remember that
other people can do what they
want. Yeah, but also that it's not always altruism that drives your emotions. Sometimes you have a feeling or a thought or an opinion and you feel like you're helping someone else, but actually you're trying to help yourself or work through something. You know, so it's not always altruistic. I think it's disingenuous to say you're always trying to help people if sometimes it's more to do with your own feelings or emotions about something.
But your book and the running and being, like I said, again, being open about your mental health will have helped so many people. Mm. Yes, it helped you, but I don't think you thought, maybe I'm completely wrong, but...
Oh, no, Gabby, I just did it for the money. No, yeah, I'm joking.
You thought, right, this is helping me. It's not going to help anyone else. You knew what you were doing. You knew you could help people.
Yeah, I mean, I think I wrote it partly for me, partly for others. Obviously, again, you don't know as a writer who's going to read it or what the reception will be like. You have no idea. And that's always the kind of added nice surprise at the end. And I had no idea that I was besieged by messages. I mean, really, honestly, like thousands and thousands and thousands of messages I've had over the last, whatever it is, 6 years since I wrote that book, from mainly women, sometimes men, talking about anxiety and OCD and depression and medication and therapy And at the beginning, it was a bit overwhelming because obviously I'm not a trained professional and I can't give someone advice or take on that kind of trauma for them. So that was quite difficult in the beginning. Now it's lovely because I feel like I know where I am and I know what the boundary is and all of that kind of stuff. But I had no idea it would help people like that. And I had no idea that being that honest would chime with other people who would go, oh, right, yeah, no, that's what it's like for me. Because I think I felt like the mental health space, and I think it's still true, is kind of too sanitized. You know, there's a lot of talk about how it's okay not to be okay. And, you know, we all have mental problems and please talk to someone, all of these kind of messages. But I think actually the reality of so much of mental illness is kind of terrifying, scary, so isolating. And you have the weirdest thoughts and you think no one else is thinking this. You know, you can't find any information or literature about it. You're thinking, oh my God, you know, someone describes anxiety as just feeling a bit nervous, but I, you know, can't go out of my house or I'm scared of being poisoned. You think, oh, I'm going mad. You know, so to actually write all of that stuff down, I think was a relief for other people who thought, that's amazing. Thank you for writing down the weirdest bits because it makes me feel less alone. Yeah. So that was a surprise. But as I say, like, that's kind of the great thing about writing is that there's a surprise at the end, which is what other people think. And that's not always good, but when it is good, it's lovely. And when it's not good, it's interesting because you think, okay, fine. You know, that's not the angle I would have thought it from. So, you know, lots of people didn't like the end of How to Kill Your Family. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, because I think it's, you know, the only way it could have ended. But lots of people get very angry with me. And I think that's great, because I think, okay, fine, you've got input into this. Yes. You know, we're having a dialogue.
They're investing
yeah.
in it.
Yeah, because it can't, nothing these days, and you'll know this from your long career as kind of a presenter, which is at the beginning of your career, presumably, you know, there's kind of a wall between you and the audience. You know, there's a kind of pre-social media. You are the presenter, you do what you do, and it goes out to an audience that can't contact you very easily. But now
with change,
yeah, right. Yeah. So now you get feedback on your podcast, on your shows, whatever you're doing, the audience can be in contact with you. And obviously sometimes they're like, oh, that was rubbish. But mostly it's interesting, it's thoughtful, it's funny, and I like that there's a dialogue now that people can have that kind of interaction with readers or listeners or whoever it is.
But I think that's what books do. I think books are like I said, sort of as I started, that you can disappear into that world. Mm. And that when a book takes you in and you're there in that world, it's just, and I mean, I'm passionate about books because you can picture those things yourself. And I always used to be upset if somebody saw a film before they read the book.
Mm.
Because I said, no, you're not painting those pictures. Mm. So we've all got our pictures of your characters and how they look. Even you describe them carefully, but we have our own in our head. I'm closing my eyes because I'm there in that world, and it's such a precious thing because it's just between the reader and the writer.
Yeah,
because it's such a unique
and the reader and the characters as well. Yeah. Because the way you think about characters in your favorite books will never be the same as anyone else. Yeah. You know, so that's so brilliant and wonderful, and also that it is such a calming thing to do to read, because you do have to put your phone away. You do have to, all distractions do have to go somewhere else, and you're doing something just for you. And I think, I mean, that probably explains why the majority of fiction readers are women, is because that's time just for them when they're not working, looking after the children, making dinner, doing all of those things. You know, it's just that beautiful 15 minutes, if you can grab it, just to, you know, just to escape into another world. And it's such a good thing to do, actually, for your mental health, is to read books. Yeah, it really is. And every time I read a book, I think, oh, why haven't I picked a book up in 2 weeks? Because this feeling is so fantastic, you know, and it makes such a difference to your head. It just calms everything down. It quietens everything. It sort of lets your, you know, imagination expand. It's just, yeah, I mean, reading, I mean, everyone knows that. I don't think it's controversial, is it? No one's saying it's actually very bad for you. It's not a good thing to do.
It's a wonderful thing. Before we finish, just talk about Mr. Mackey.
Of course.
Is it okay that I tell you to your face that I love your husband?
Of course.
I see him at work, and Greg is just brilliant. And I think you two together, there was a very funny article I read, "We're not the new Richard and Judy." It's like, no, you're not. You're Bella and Greg. You're Greg and Bella, and together. I mean, he's fantastic. He's a genius. He's a genius broadcaster. He's so clever. And I love that he's daring, because I think a lot of television and radio is a little safe. Mm. And it can be a bit safe everywhere, but he pushes the boundaries in a really good, positive way. He's never nasty. He's never hypercritical. He's clever.
Yeah. No, he is. I'm in awe of the way he broadcasts. Obviously I'm kind of shy and I get nervous about doing anything like that. And the way he does it is, I find it completely, it's watching someone with their craft. You know, it's so interesting to see someone.
He's a master of his craft. Yeah. In the same way that Chris Evans, you know, when a lot of people say, oh, he's like Chris was. Mm. Chris Evans, he looked at things and he was a produce something and he'd push it to the nth degree and to make it work brilliantly. And Greg looks at things like that. I think Greg is just fantastic. I absolutely love him.
And actually, I mean, you know, I think, you know, sometimes people make jokes about their partners. Oh, you know, you should see them, whatever, you know, when they're at home or whatever. He's a lovely, lovely man. And I'm so ridiculously lucky to have found him, because...
And he's lucky to have found you.
Oh, he's very lucky to have found me. You know, he's very lucky. His mother once joked, just before we got married, she said, "You're not who I thought Greg would end up with." And I said, "Who did you think Greg would end up with?" And she said, "I don't know, sort of maybe like a 26-year-old yoga sort of influencer or something." And I thought, okay, I don't know if that's worse for Greg or me. Is that worse for him or me?
So funny.
I know, it was so funny. I was laughing so much. But, you know, he is lucky to have found me, because I sort of pull things out of him and he pulls things out of me. And also, he's so optimistic. He's so joyful and cheerful and genuine. He's like that all the time. And I'm a huge pessimist. I'm not joyful. I'm horribly cynical.
I love that you've come on reasons to be joyful.
I know. I was thinking about it and I was thinking, oh God, I'm going to really have to like dig deep for this one. But I love being with someone who's like that, because it's like watching us. We go through the world, we're seeing the same things and we have entirely different... I'll say, oh no, you know, the sky is falling in. And he's saying, no, look, it's so beautiful. Actually, what's happening is it's just expanding, you know. And I love that. I think that's such a wonderful thing. And I think I probably get the better end of the deal there, which is that I get this joyful, cheerful person all the time. And he gets me going, what if the sky falls in? But no, he's a doll and I love him. And he's made my life infinitely better. And I can't believe we've been together 7 years. And I just, after having a marriage explode after 9 months, the idea of being with someone for 7 years feels insane to me.
And the next seven and seven and seven and seven.
Yeah. I'm not letting him go now. Like, I'm not having a third Mr. Mackey. We're sticking with this one.
No, it's a good one that you're sticking with. Bella, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.